There you go.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'll introduce myself. I was looking forward to seeing Betty. I haven't seen her in a while, and she's an old friend since we're both ethicists. So that's the hint about my self-introduction, is I'm primarily an ethicist. I have taught for 25 years. I've taught biomedical ethics, I guess you could call it, and especially clinical ethics in medical schools. And about 5 years ago, I moved to Houston, Texas to become the director of a campus-wide ethics program. So I've broadened my focus from just medical issues and clinical issues to nursing ethics and dental ethics, and we have a huge school of public health. And the School of Public Health has about 250 Master of Public Health graduate students per year come in. And I proposed, because I'm trying to promote ethics in the curriculum at all the schools, that they add a required course on public health ethics. They didn't have that before. And so I've been teaching 250 students a year a required course on public health ethics, and I thought I would share with you one small part of it. I assume that every school of public health has a required class in public health ethics, and that's why I was so assertive that we had to do it at our school. And then I found out that I was kind of bluffing, and I didn't realize that. But in the discussion, I hope we can talk about whether there should be a required ethics course at every school of public health. And I'm happy to share ideas with people more broadly. I see myself primarily as an educator, ethics is my topic. No relationships to disclose. My proposal in teaching the public health ethics, what I noticed was, and we can talk about this a lot more, I'm not sure where your interests are, but I noticed that one of the reasons that there's resistance to teaching public health ethics in schools of public health is that I think there's a kind of defense mechanism that says, that's really medical ethics. You're going to come here and teach us medical ethics. And we're not all doctors, and we don't want doctors to be given some false sense that they are the most important part of public health. And we do something that we think is more important and different. And so it's, I think, very important to establish right from the beginning that public health ethics is not the same subject as medical ethics. And I teach medical ethics to medical students and nursing ethics to nursing students and public health ethics to public health students. And you need to be secure enough to say we do have our own identity and we have our own ethics, and we need it for us as much as they need to teach their ethics and their programs. And it is part of professionalization of a field, I think, to have a code of ethics, to teach the code of ethics, to talk about what are the most common problems you deal with in your field, and what are the standards that people have agreed upon, built a consensus over a long period of time. So my proposal today, and I'm going to try to move faster, is that we use a principles approach. And if you know biomedical ethics, you know that the principles approach is the dominant approach there. And if you know the four principles, you might think, oh, that's not such a bad idea. Or you might think, uh-oh, he's trying to sneak in that biomedical ethics stuff that we don't like. Or you might have heard people who like to criticize the principles approach. And I think in the field of biomedical ethics, you know, physicians and people who teach in medical school, I find that probably the majority know the principles and are comfortable with them and like them, but a very large number are irritated by them and try to argue with them and propose something better. But what I find interesting and I think very significant is that the people who want to replace it with something better spend almost their entire career, from assistant professor to death, arguing against the principles, and the principles are still there when they die. So I think my conclusion is that they're only 30, 35 years old and they've been enormously successful. Maybe there's a reason for that, and maybe we should learn from that experience and realize that saying that there's one theory that's perfect for us or one principle that's perfect for us won't work for public health if it didn't work for biomedical ethics. And public health, if anything, is a bigger field, so we shouldn't even try. We should say, if we could boil it down to four principles, we're doing pretty well. So the whole idea is that principles are not theories. They don't explain everything. They are called mid-level principles. And when you have a dilemma, the principles don't explain it away. They just show probably the reason it's a dilemma is because one principle would support one course of action and another principle would support a different course of action. And the four principles are independent from each other. So they can help explain complexity, but they don't get rid of complexity. So public health ethics, what makes it different from biomedical ethics? Of course, primarily public health's focus on groups, populations, and society. Rather than individuals. You don't try to cure one person at a time like in medicine, but to find sources of diseases and social conditions of diseases and treat those or change those. There's always the big concern in public health ethics that what I always tell my public health students is you're considered the good guys. When physicians meet and somebody says, I have an MPH, what do you think they are telling you? I think they're telling you, it's not that they're saying I'm smarter than the MDs that don't have an MPH, but they probably are saying I have a social conscience and I'm very concerned about ethics and I'm going to help us think about it in a bigger picture. So I do think you add something to it. The concern that's introduced is always that the need of society will overrule the needs of individuals. So, you know, the claim at least that Nazi eugenics program was kind of a public health movement. For example, or even that Tuskegee was public health research. So there is a concern that public health ethics might trod on the rights of people. So I think we have to find a group of four mid-level principles that shows what our ideals are and how we also try to protect rights of individuals while we try to promote the good of society. So. Just another side, for those who want to find one theory and not have to have four principles or three principles or five principles, I actually don't believe that single theories have been nearly as successful as we thought. John Stuart Mill and utilitarianism is a phenomenal theory and a fun theory and a powerful theory, but I don't know that it's a single theory. You know, when you read him, he's got the harm principle and he's got the greatest happiness principle. And one seems much more focused on the good of the individual, what society can't do. And so this is a great quote from Mill. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised against any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant. So this is asserting, this is the kind of quote from his book on liberty that libertarians love. And I think that was as important to him as the greatest happiness for the greatest number, which was kind of almost sounds Marxist in comparison. So I think he had, to be what sounds like a great theory, he had to include something that addressed individuals and groups' different needs and rights. So to cut to the chase, this is my proposal. I'm willing to change any of the four principles. This is kind of preliminary. This is what I show in my class. So in my course, I introduce the four principles of biomedical ethics so they see what a lot of physicians are taught in medical school. And then I introduce this as four principles for public health. And I say, if you are going to be an MD, MPH, you're going to want to know both. And if you're going to be an MPH with a doctor in public health, you're going to want to know these, and it's still helpful to know what the medical principles are too. So they're learning, you could say, eight principles, but four are strictly the principles of ethics for public health. So how did I arrive at these? Well, I've taught the course two semesters a year for 5 years, so 10 times. And during that time, I've read a lot of articles and a lot of books. I guarantee that I'm totally convinced that many, many people in this room have read much more in public health than I have and more in public health ethics. So that's why I'm not doctrinaire about this. This is kind of a first draft from somebody in the field. But what I noticed when I read a lot of books is that these four principles come up a lot, or different versions or something similar that could be translated into these. Just like with biomedical ethics, there is a version that has three principles, and there are textbooks that have five or six, and there's nothing to me that's repugnant to having three or five or six, but four seems to have won the day in biomedical ethics: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. So I don't see why we shouldn't try to make do with four. That should be enough to do justice to individuals and groups. So my four principles for public health ethics are procedural justice that require the participation of anybody who will be affected in the process of decision making. So this requires, as a precondition, everybody speak truthfully, not be evasive, have public meetings, community outreach, community input, community participation, with the goal of building a public consensus. So all of that, which is thousands of articles and hundreds of books summarized into one principle, and you could change the name if you want, but I call it procedural justice. Second one, I cut the definition down so I could fit on one slide, but least restrictive alternative. I think this has been in a lot of literature about a lot of really important subjects, and the more I think about it, the more I think it actually deserves to be recognized as one specific principle. When there is a goal that you have and there are different ways you might achieve it, think very hard about the way to achieve it that does the least damage to people's individual rights and freedom. Let people be as stupid as you can possibly let them be, so long as it doesn't harm others, to kind of paraphrase John Stuart Mill. The third principle, the precautionary principle, to maximize human safety and environmental sustainability when the evidence is not yet conclusive, but there is reason to think that there's a risk of damage and the damage could be severe and irreversible. And then the fourth, the communitarian principle, I think there are philosophers and some people in public health ethics who, when they discovered communitarianism, thought they had found the mother lode, a rich ore that would answer every question. And I think at first I was resistant to that, but now I see what its purpose was, I think, is to be the principle that talks about the greater social good and why we have some duty to contribute to it. So we have to consider the importance for our own mental health and our own physical health that being a member of a society does. And then we have to recognize reciprocity, that we have to pay back to the society whatever is necessary for others to enjoy those same benefits and opportunities. So next I have just four slides that go into a little more detail about the four. So procedural justice requires, or at least encourages, participation of anybody who could be affected in the decision-making process. If it affects an entire community, then everybody should be informed beforehand and have an opportunity for input. It does slow things up, but I think that is the democratic process. If a decision could put someone else at risk, and that individual has definitely the right to input, needs to be specifically addressed what they think of this before you do it. And to work, it requires transparency, truthful information, public meetings. I mentioned all that before. Least restrictive alternative, a little more detail. To promote freedom and liberty, one must find the way to achieve a goal that does not impose on human rights or does so with the least burden possible. Going back to John Stuart Mill and the harm principle, as I mentioned. And we should have the freedom to do things that are not particularly wise. Better to have nine people make a mistake than one person be denied the chance to make a mistake. That's a really bad paraphrase of a major legal opinion. But the point is, we do value people's freedom. Also under this, in the medical realm, it's kind of protection of a lot of religious freedom. People can decide they don't want a blood transfusion, for example. It might not seem wise to doctors, but they recognize the right to do that. And this also, I think, helps contribute to the concern of deontologists like Kant and Rawls, that you have to protect the individual's rights. You can only justify restrictions on individuals if it's going to protect the rights of... You can only restrict the freedoms of people if you make sure to minimize it as much as you can. So, and then precautionary principle, to maximize human safety when there's some scientific evidence of risk, but it's inconclusive. At the least, this applies to cases where the damage risk is severe and cannot be undone. can be thought of as part of justice, in that it would be an injustice if one allowed an avoidable harm to occur because of a lack of sufficient evidence at the time. There are decisions that have to be made now, and the effects will occur. You can't wait until all the evidence is in. I think that's very important to acknowledge in the role of using mid-level principles to help guide your decision-making. Colloquially, this can be thought of as better safe than sorry principle. And then communitarian, just the last few slides here. The importance of weighing social institutions and social connections to individual well-being to define our reciprocal obligation to the group. In health professions in the past at least 10 years, there's been a fantastic amount of research that is so interesting about the social determinants of health, showing that genetic contributions and personal responsibility, though they're both important, those combined are never the entire story. It's also the society you live in, the neighborhoods you live in, the kind of policing in the neighborhood where you live, the kind of food that's available in the neighborhood where you live. So many things are determined by the community. And a lot of us who have prospered or flourished, to use an old Aristotelian term, had the advantage of very good communities that we grew up in. So our own health and well-being depends on how others have treated us. We should reciprocate, and we owe it to contribute to others' well-being. A little more on this, as I said, I think as an undergraduate, as a philosophy and classics major, I think because speaking a language was too difficult, so I went for Latin and Greek. But at any rate, what I thought was an easy way out, I ended up having to take about 6 courses on Aristotle at the University of Chicago. So I have had some suffering in my life. But taking a cue from Aristotle's humanistic ethics, commentators would say the communitarian principle includes what is necessary to flourish, to use that Aristotelian interpretation, to achieve your potential. And that might mean a lot more than just healthcare, but also education, employment, and a lot of other goods. I think one of the issues for public health is always going to be drawing the boundaries. What is our responsibility? What isn't? I think communitarian principle also really helps define why the free rider problem seems like cheating. Someone seems unethical if they refuse vaccination, for example. This is very close to, I think it could be called probably the principle of social justice, if you think that's a better term. I think social justice is a little more vague and even harder to pin down. What are the limits that you would include in public health ethics? But I do like the Powers and Faden book, Social Justice. I recommend that to my students under the category of for further reading. And then the last possible extension for communitarian principle, we were talking about environmental health and environmental ethics just before we started. This is also a principle that can be pretty easily extended if you want to include it in public health ethics, to defend the physical commons as a contributor to our health, as well as the social commons. So it could be used to say we need to protect the quality of resources for a healthy life, such as clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, safe food to eat, safe neighborhoods to live in, and even policies that could cause or prevent droughts and floods. Floods delayed my arrival here by 6 hours, by the way, coming from Texas. In these cases, we need the participation of others in order to achieve these goals for ourselves, and so we also must be willing to contribute our share to others' ability to enjoy the physical commons or the common good. And at the very least, I also like to include a little bit on environmental racism, something that was first made known in some lawsuits in North Carolina. But Robert Bullard in Houston has great books and articles on environmental racism in the South. So my last slide, so my timing seems to be pretty good. If you look at the 4 principles for public health ethics and compare it to the 4 principles of biomedical ethics, autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice, one of the things that is really only after I wrote these 4 principles and decided on 4 that I compared them and thought, you know, there is a way in which I think it's a very good analogy, a very good extension. You can see how autonomy is represented at a population level with procedural justice. You can see how beneficence enlarged is a least restrictive alternative, how non-maleficence enlarged to populations is precautionary principle, and justice enlarged to social groups is communitarian principle. So I actually think if you are somebody who for some reason loves the original four principles of biomedical ethics, you could say, aha, you see, they're still good. I've just extended them to populations. And if you don't care about them, you can ignore that claim and just say, it's coincidence, but there are four good principles for public health ethics that establishes it's different from biomedical ethics and important to teach in a required class on public health ethics at every school in the country. Thank you.